Hello, this is Mark Brown for Beyond the Room at the Institute for Mental Health and Centre for Brain Health launch event in what is now still quite drizzly Birmingham, and I'm here with...
Heidi Johansenberg from Oxford.
And Heidi's just given another fantastic, really interesting presentation about brain health, cognitive health and physical activity. So I want to set you up with a kind of interesting question to begin with, which is, lots of people seem to think that physical activity is a cure both for mental illness and for cognitive decline or cognitive illness. What does your research say in regards to that lifestyle article take?
Yeah, interesting question. So I think in terms of cognitive decline, so thinking of sort of late life cognitive decline and neurodegeneration dementia, I think there is real scope for physical exercise or other types of lifestyle interventions delaying onset. I don't think anyone would claim that those types of interventions would cure Alzheimer's disease, for example, but what they might conceivably do is push back the onset of symptoms such that somebody's quality of life would be better for longer. So I think that's the potential at that end. With mental health difficulties through the lifespan, I think that's really interesting. So that's not something that we've directly looked at in terms of effects of physical activity on mental health outcomes. But certainly, I think as far as the literature says currently, that there are a number of studies which suggest that physical activity has about the same beneficial effects as antidepressants in mood disorder. So, I think that there's I'm not sure that anyone would tout that as a cure, but in terms of symptomatic relief, I think there's a lot of interest and enthusiasm around exercise as one route. And one of the exciting things about these non-pharmacological interventions is that they might be additive. I think that's if it might be that you could combine, say, a physical activity intervention, an antidepressant and a sleep intervention, each of which has a beneficial effect, you might then see a much bigger total improvement in symptoms, for example.
So you were carrying out the FIT study. Could you tell the people at home a bit more about that? Because it seemed to involve, like, I kind of picked up very much the idea that doing stuff with school children, schools aren't laboratories.
Yes.
Can you give us a bit more background on that study and where you're at with it?
Yeah, sure. So this was a large-scale randomised controlled trial of a physical activity intervention in secondary schools. And the motivation for it was that our funder, the Education Endowment Foundation, who fund educational research, they wanted to take the sort of clinical trials model and apply it in schools because, understandably, there's a lot of dissatisfaction that whereas to implement a new drug in the NHS requires a really high bar in terms of level of evidence, the same does not apply for interventions in our schools. So some, quack policy could be implemented in our schools with zero evidence. It's more a question of, powers of persuasion. So what the EF...
So it sounds like you speak from sort of experience or insight there about quack policies.
Well, I just think that you see a lot. It's an interesting contrast that while both things come, both health and education come within the sort of government's remit, the requirement for evidence is totally different across the two. So that's something that the EF want to counter, is saying, well, if you want to do something in schools, you first test it rigorously and let's see if it works. So that's where FIT study came from. It's a large-scale trial where what we're testing is whether inserting extra bursts of vigorous activity in school PE to see what effect that has on academic outcomes, but also on lots of other measures around brain and cognitive health. So I think it's a really interesting model. I think it's a really valuable and laudable approach. But it's the reality of doing those kinds of studies is that it's really, really, really hard. So whereas, if you were a drug company wanting to run a large-scale clinical trial of a drug, there's a massive infrastructure, clinical trials unit set up to do that. People know how that's done in a very straightforward way in thousands and thousands of people. Whereas what tends to happen more in education research is that, it's your... trying to build up these relationships with schools. Every school is different. The schools are under massive amounts of other pressures, and this is one more thing to add to the burden. So the whole starting conditions for an educational trial are quite different and with some types of clinical trials. But I do think it is the way that we should move out of the lab into the real world, test interventions that are actually feasible to deliver in the real world. Because it's all very well showing that something is effective in this very artificial situation in a lab. That might be interesting scientifically, but it doesn't help us know what we should be doing in schools, for example.
I think that's a really interesting kind of point to expand on a bit. The kind of the bringing together of neuroscience and things that have practical impacts in people's everyday life. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that there is a lot of potential for neuroscience to be used to motivate intervention. You know, we all sort of understand it to some extent, but then it can be, you know, misused is too strong, but it can be potentially a little bit misinterpreted or used in a way to support, you know, a new way of doing something. Whereas I think there really is a need to require evidence for that and to use the neuroscience. So where there are so many different places, contexts in real life where the brain is relevant, whether that's education, you know, rehabilitation, sports coaching, you know, all of these different domains where there is an awful lot known about the neuroscience and psychology of all of those different processes, and bringing those community, the applied sort of practitioners, closer together with the scientists to make sure that the practitioners have access to the best quality science, and the scientists can, you know, steer their science to answer questions that are actually relevant to what the practitioners are doing, that would be a good thing.
Because I think it's a really interesting thing that happens, because I kind of surf the tides of quackery a bit. And the misuse of neuroscience in the selling of terrible interventions, useless interventions, potentially dangerous interventions, is really strong. Like, what advice would you have to anyone at home that was looking at, you know, an MRI scan or something like that, and being told that this was evidence of X? Like, how should a lay person interpret claims that come from, you know, possibly from neuroscience, possibly from misapplied neuroscience?
Yeah, well, I think that always asking questions, what are you actually showing me? What is that? What does that represent? I think that's one of the, you know, it's a strength and a danger in neuroscience that we have these very compelling pictures that are produced, and, you know, we can put blobs on brains and it makes something look scientific. But actually digging a bit into that in terms of, you know, well, what's that showing? You know, what's that data from? How many people is that from? You know, trying to, like one would with any bit of evidence, you know, that blob on a brain should be interrogated in the same way as a scatterplot plot of data points or a graph. It's, you know, it has all of the same pitfalls as any bit of scientific evidence. And the more we can train our school children and educate the public to question in a constructive way bits of evidence that's being presented to them, the better.
Brilliant. So that's kind of wonderfully meta point to end on. So you have to use the brain to interpret things about the brain. And thank you for that. That was great.